Thanks for listening to A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins, in partnership with Briefcase News, the service that brings intelligent curation and analysis to your media monitoring. This is a bit of a new direction for us. It's part of a series that we want to make looking at iconic companies that went wrong or disappeared. And the idea is to look at why that happened, what it meant, and whether things could have turned out differently. And we thought we'd start with a company that really looms very large, or used to loom very large in the British industrial scene, which was ICI, or Imperial Chemical Industries, which was often seen as British industry in one great big box, wasn't it, Neil?
Yeah, it was considered to be the bellwether of British industry. Whether that was right or not is another matter, but it was certainly, it did bestride its markets. Ooh. Like a sort of crumbling colossus.
Like a colossus, okay. anyway, it was founded in 1926, really explicitly to create a British chemicals giant to rank alongside IG Farben, DuPont of America. And it was, for decades, Britain's largest manufacturing company. It enjoyed a very strong position in the UK and the Commonwealth and was very innovative business. I think by 1993, which is, of course, when it split up, it had generated 50,000 patents, apparently. Whether those were particularly remunerative, we'll find out. But unlike a lot of British industrial giants, which sort of seemed to slowly sort of get caught and worn down by years of underinvestment and failure, outdated products and what have you, before finally collapsing in the face of foreign competition, ICI sort of really did itself in.
Yeah, I think that's much too harsh, actually. The businesses and the markets that it was in were clearly not the place to be in the long term. So although they broke themselves apart, I don't think you can say that they self-immolated.
Well, anyway, before you shoot down the very premise of this podcast, I think we're going to bring in somebody who actually has looked at the history of ICI and has written a fantastic book about the decline of British industry called Surrender: How British Industry Gave Up the Ghost 1952 to 2012. So I'm very pleased to welcome author, journalist, and industrial commentator Nick Comfort. Nick, hi.
Hi, Jonathan. Hi, Neil.
Nick, you've heard our sort of half-baked views on ICI and its significance, but perhaps you can sketch out for us how you saw, as a long-time sort of industrial watcher of the scene, the sort of importance of ICI and its sort of status within the British manufacturing world.
Well, I think in a sense ICI was the bedrock of British industry. It was producing all sorts of really basic things that other firms needed, everything from salt to urea. Also, it was a pioneer of man-made fibres, and a lot of those patents were in man-made fibres, though in fact they thinned out rather alarmingly in the post-war years. And of course, you had the Dulux paint business. So take those three things and quite a lot more. And it really did look like a fixture. And I think the difficulty was, first of all, that in the early Thatcher years, when Britain's smokestack industry started collapsing, they were the customers for a lot of the raw materials. And ICI quite rightly realised that they weren't going to be able to go on producing them to the same extent and relying so heavily. The next thing was that the British textile industry was declining, and even before Marks and Spencer decided to offshore its production, there simply wasn't the same demand for those fabrics, and indeed those fabrics were also going out of use. Crimpline, one of the great ICI inventions, pretty well faded out in the 1970s. And so you could see that, if you like, two legs of the stool were already not what they had been. So getting into other things was quite a sensible thing to do. Then you had the dramatic success of the pharmaceuticals business, which had never in the past been all that large. And if you look at the decision to float off Zeneca, which then forms up with AstraZeneca, ICI might have been wise to look at what had happened when Raycal floated off Vodafone. Vodafone became a massive business and Raycal ceased to exist. But up till the 90s, except for one disastrous year at the beginning of the Thatcher period when ICI issued a profits warning and actually made a loss, which really put the fear of God into the British business. It was viable, it was profitable, and then some rather flaky decisions got made, and I have a friend who actually had the job of winding the company up, and he said it was the saddest thing he'd ever done because it was all so pointless.
If we go back a bit, though, perhaps to the 60s and 70s, it was a business very much that was built around domination of certain markets, particularly in the Commonwealth and in Britain, as you've said. And it didn't have such a strong position in places like Europe and the United States. Things like, you know, the UK joining the European Economic Community in 1973, which would have effectively reduced a lot of the kind of tariff barriers around ICI's home market and other markets in which it operated. To what extent did that really begin to change the picture and make the kind of coherent structure, if you like, which existed beforehand, seem sort of slightly outdated?
Well, for a start, it gave the German companies like Bayer a much greater interest in selling in Britain. But also ICI was very slow off the mark in getting involved in Europe. It did have one small German business that it set up. But as we went into the EEC, it chose to go far more into the United States. And there were a couple of big plants opened there. And the whole structure of ICI was not equipped, really, for dealing with the great new opportunities that were supposed to exist in Europe.
Why was that?
I think it was a cultural thing. It was in the DNA of ICI that it was there to do a particular thing. And although the management of ICI, in other respects, was enterprising during that period, it just didn't seem to register with them that they needed to get involved in Europe to the extent that European firms were getting involved in Britain.
Yeah, their focus was really on the old Commonwealth, wasn't it?
Very much
so. And that was not a particularly attractive place to be compared to the markets of Europe and, to a lesser extent, in America. I don't think their failure in America was quite so bad, but they should have seen that the world had changed when we joined the common market.
So we have the 70s, they come through the 70s, which is obviously a turbulent period because of rising oil prices. Chemicals companies are obviously quite affected by fossil fuel prices, and the slow economic growth of the 70s would have also been a drag. The 80s, as you say, start with this colossal recession, which is a huge shock to ICI and makes it think that it needs to restructure. How effective was their sort of change of heart, if you like, or willingness to change in the 1980s, when you had people like John Harvey Jones in charge, who's quite a well-known figure, I think?
Well, I think in a way, having John Harvey Jones in charge obscured the difficulties they were having in changing the culture. Here you had this marvellous sort of quintessentially English figure who presents himself as an entrepreneur, goes on to do this TV series about how to have a successful business. Mm. But so much of ICI was about process. Mm. I suspect administrative as much as manufacturing. Mm. And its heart was really still in these colossal chemical plants in the north. I don't think there was an enormous amount of new thinking.
No, well, surely the thing that really galvanised them was the attack from Hansen.
Well, that came a bit later.
Yeah, but that was the thing that really concentrated their minds, in my view.
Yes, it was. I mean, in a sense, they were still profitable. They still were happy with themselves. But ICI increasingly was seen by corporate raiders as a sort of beach whale. It looked an awful lot stronger on paper and in the balance sheet than it was in terms of its actual activities. And then it started selling off a few bits and pieces. And Hansen took one look at it and thought, this looks a soft target, let's make some noise and see what happens. And what did happen was that ICI suddenly started looking an awful lot less strong.
So we're talking now in 1991, and as you say, ICI has been through a kind of another restructuring programme and has announced that it's going to cost hundreds of millions of pounds to reorganise their portfolio. Hansen takes his stake. But what is significant about Hansen taking his stake in April 1991, which is a small stake of about 2.8%, is the exaggerated reaction, which doesn't just come from ICI headquarters, where everyone is alarmed and keen to, as you say, put out lots of defensive material, rubbishing Lord Hansen and his sponsorship of horse races and the Derby and Gordon White, who was Lord Hanson's sidekick, you know, living it high at company expense and all of that sort of stuff. But the really significant point was that the government is also sees this as a strategic industry and doesn't want Hanson to start doing his sort of characteristic thing of buying a giant British company and pulling it apart.
I think there were two things going on. There was certainly in the establishment that view. On the other hand, we'd had 10 years of Thatcherism, during which increasingly the view of some people in government, such as Lord Young, was that it was much better to make money than make things, and really manufacturing was old hat. And in a sense, Hanson, one of the reasons he was one of the last people who did what he was doing, was that there weren't that many people after him, until perhaps Jim Ratcliffe, who were interested in taking over industrial companies, stripping them down and making them work.
Yes, I think your comment about Young is a bit harsh. I don't think they were against making things, but there was no point in making things if you couldn't make money out of the process.
True.
So I remember covering the Hanson attack, and the defence was one of the dirtiest I'd ever seen. I mean, this large, wonderful company managed to recruit all sorts of people who were dishing the dirt on Hanson. And I think that that sort of response did not, in the end, win ICI any friends. And it helped to lay the foundations for what came next.
In a sense, I think that was almost seen as a sign of desperation. It was an oath from the pulpit, because of all the companies who you would not expect to fight dirty, ICI was probably the premier example.
Yeah, quite.
One of the things which people look at ICI and its history, and they say the decision to allow ICI, and we'll come to how ICI does sort of break itself up and disappear in a minute, the decision, you know, to sort of stand aside and take a very laissez-faire view of what happened to ICI and its disintegration is a sign of Britain not really having any sense of what its own economy was about. Do you think that's true, or do you think that they just had a sense that whatever their economy was about, it wasn't about bulk chemicals anymore?
Well, there's a big debate going on at the moment in the States about whether industrial policy is something that ought to be had, and a surprising number of people across the political spectrum are saying you actually need one. Hmm. And I think the late Thatcher years, the early Meiji years, possibly, were the point at which industrial policy was least considered a good thing. This rumbled on. I worked in the DTI for a time in the early 2000s, and the idea wasn't dead, but people could see there was some point in having one. But I think at this precise moment, particularly as the basic chemical need was not seen as so great, and certainly the things ICI were producing in the north were not seen as strategically important in a way perhaps that they would be now, in a sense, it was allowed to happen.
Yeah, you say it as if you think that this was a disaster. I have to say, I'm not convinced that it was. I would say that it was sort of accelerated evolution. And as my friend Christopher Fildes has remarked, if they'd called the pharmaceutical side ICI and called the old ICI something else, then it would still be at the top of the charts today, as it is through AstraZeneca. I don't think we should weep too much for this, for what has happened.
I'm going to interject a note of disagree. I mean, I think what you substitute, you obviously don't have much of an industrial policy, you know, certainly as far as these industrial companies, which are largely in decline, is concerned, as to what it is the economy should do. If you look at the story of ICI, there are two things in play, I think. One is this idea that the market will decide what happens to very large companies, and that will be driven by shareholders' preferences and decisions about what is seen to be fast-growing and what is seen to be valuable at the time. And clearly that drives the decision to demerge Zeneca in 1993. It's the idea that pharmaceuticals is a fast-growing business, chemicals not. If you strip out all the boring old chemical stuff, the stock price will go up, which will be good. And also the company will be able to acquire other pharmaceutical companies with paper, which is indeed what did later happen with the acquisition of Astra, or the merger, I can't remember what it was.
Merger.
The other side of it, I think, where there is an industrial policy of sorts, it is basically a decision that the world, which is becoming more globalized, is open. We don't need to worry about owning all the things we need to consume. We can get them from somewhere in the world. It'll all be fine. And if we are to worry about anything, it is to make sure that our specialism, which is largely in financial services, is one that's going to flourish. So the energy in industrial policy all goes into that. That's what I would say. So you don't have an absence of it. You just have a different focus.
Well, I think the argument that you major in financial services, it isn't really an industrial policy, it's something else. I think Neil's right. I think the important thing is that most of what ICI used to do is still being done.
Yeah.
A lot of it's not being done by British firms. Quite a lot of it's being done by INEOS. It's not a situation like the collapse of GEC, where most of what GEC did isn't being done anymore. And great swathes of industrial capacity were handed over, particularly to the French, and where one corporate mistake followed another. I mean, if you like, GEC is suicide. I don't think you can say that about ICI, because an awful lot of it is still going on under other names. A few key things have been lost. There are various chemical plants who are producing things that no one else in Britain produced and which are pretty hard to get hold of. But the results from that have not probably been as serious as they were supposed to have been.
What I'd like to do is to just throw it forward a bit from the point where Zeneca is demerged, because clearly the pharmaceuticals business, as you say, becomes very successful and valuable as an independent listed company. But then you have what's often referred to as the rump of ICI. And it does seem to me that there's something quite interesting about what happens with that, because you have a series of managers who look at this portfolio and they go, oh, this is terrible. We've got all this boring old, you know, industrial stuff we don't want to do. We want to do something which is much more exciting and valuable, which is to make flavors and fragrances. So they basically take on a huge amount of debt, buying some very expensive businesses, £5 billion worth of businesses from in these sort of exciting new areas, and then find that because they're now a highly leveraged business, they can't even sell off. It's a bit of a GEC story almost, this. They can't get rid of the old stuff for enough money to basically make the whole business viable. Is that a fair description of what happens?
I think it is. I think the thing became unbalanced. The whole fragrances thing, people found it very hard to see how it could be made to work, and it looked slightly flaky, as I said before. So in a sense, it turned out it didn't produce anything much in the way of revenues.
And it produced a lot in the way of debt.
Yes.
So in the end, they basically, as you say, they did sell off large parts of their old business to INEOS in a kind of desperate attempt to try and reshore up their balance sheet after they had basically taken on that sort of idea, the idea that we need to reinvent a business by selling off the boring bits and doing exciting new expensive things, seems to me a very unsuccessful business strategy.
Well, it rather depends what you do, doesn't it?
Well, it was a thing of its time, because you had George Simpson doing exactly the same thing at GEC, and George Simpson had the advantage that he had Arnie Weinstock's massive pile of cash behind him, and he still managed to blow it. ICI didn't have huge reserves of cash, which is why they were caught.
Well, I think they were caught because they were doomed. It required the sort of root and branch restructuring, which we've seen with the new owners of so much of it, of which INEOS is the most obvious.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that most of the basic chemicals side have been operating in the same way with the same manning for a very long time. And it was inevitable that anyone else coming in would think, hang on, we could do a lot of this with more modern processes and far fewer people.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing. I don't think we should consider the demise of ICI as a national disaster.
But I want to come back to another point, which is that period, although people often look at the Thatcher period and they say, well, the British industry sort of tore itself apart, it was torn apart or whatever. If you look at it, a lot of the really big changes happen in the late 90s and early 2000s, when lots of big UK industrial companies effectively sell themselves off. And you've mentioned some. Racal would be one example. Blue Circle, the cement business, is another. These big old sort of industrial names. And ICI is another example. And the question often debated at the time in various places, which I used to work in, was, does ownership matter? And should we really be bothered about this? And the general view was, oh, well, you know, in this sort of globalized economy, it doesn't really matter. But do you think we were too careless?
I think we were. About 10 years ago, I went to hear a lecture by Terry Burns, and he said the purpose of having a company is to build it up so that you can sell it off. Hmm. Now, you may well argue with that. I think I would.
So would I. He was a civil servant, after all.
The next thing is, who do you sell it to, if that's the purpose? And there are so few potential people you can sell it to in the United Kingdom. It almost has to be American or continental. I know someone who's got a company to sell at the moment. It's a big company. It's not an industrial one. He said, well, there's no point in going for an IPO, so we'll have to sell it off. And he named a couple of companies. There are simply very few British companies, with the possible exception of INEOS, who are ready to come in and be a sort of mothership. You then have the effect of this on the stock market. You have the increasing involvement of private equity. It's part of a completely different structure. We're not really here to debate the rights and wrongs of that. But you are in a situation where continuous production of something is not seen as the aim of a company.
I don't really agree with Terry Burns's comment. No, there are plenty of other things you can do if you have a company that you own and no longer feel that you can run. I would say that the sort of industrial revolution that took place under Thatcher and continued really under Major and Blair, to support my thesis there, I would point to the British motor industry, which as soon as it was essentially owned by foreigners, it started to revive after 20 years of continuous decline.
But now they've closed most of the plants.
Well, that was then. This is now. I mean, this is that's a different. Yeah, but that's an entirely different. An entirely different situation, I would say.
Do you think? I mean, before, I know this is going to once again light a long fuse on Neil's sort of.
No, I'm
Cerberus kind of market fundamentalism.
Do you think they're liberal about this?
Do you think that where we are now, Nick, there is any merit in looking at some of these questions of industrial policy afresh, or do you think we just stick with what we have?
Well, I think there are an awful lot of battles it's not worth fighting because they're over.
Yeah.
I do think there is the need to do some of the things the Biden administration's doing, not all of them, in terms of seeing what you can do to revive your nation's industry. If people are going to discriminate against you, and we're particularly in this situation post-Brexit with Europe, are the things where we should be imposing tariffs? Possibly not. But in terms of industrial structure, there is surely a case for encouraging, not intervening, so that these motherships exist, so that if you have a sector where you've got a number of upcoming firms and they're all selling off to the Americans, as has happened particularly in the defense sector recently,
and
it's no good saying, well, if BAE Systems don't want you, you can go to the Americans. There needs to be some means by which a British firm does not have to sell itself to private equity or to an American competitor if it feels it needs to get to a further stage.
Oh dear, I think you'll be talking about a national champion next.
Not necessarily. It might not be that large. A national vehicle, possibly, I think is as far as I'd put it. We know about national champions.
They don't work.
Well, Nick, I think we've probably decided that the decline and fall of ICI, while a sad event, is not a great catastrophe for the United Kingdom that it sometimes seemed to be. INEOS is still flying the flag over the refineries and chemicals companies of the north of England. And although I'm still prepared to wrap myself in the flag of not doing everything that the market tells you to do, it's been great to talk to you about this, so thank you.
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
That was A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins. Production and editing by Nick Hilton, and our sponsorship partner is briefcase.news. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review it on your podcast app, as that will help new listeners find us.